talking all things training, sport performance, and business, and covering the most important topics to enhance your training and better your career. I'm your host, Jared DeFilippo, and this is Muscles and Management, brought to you by Challenger Strength, where we build your body and your business. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Episode 7 of the Muscles and Management Podcast. This is our first Q&A episode. Very excited about this. This is something I've wanted to do since we started the podcast. I kind of wanted to, you know, get questions from, you know, my followers on Twitter, Instagram, and kind of see what things or what topics they would like to hear me talk about and kind of address some important things in the world of sports performance. So before we get started, I kind of want to just give a general outline of the episode itself and kind of the things I'm going to be talking about. Some of these questions involve things from energy systems in team sports, how you go about training those, and what energy systems are actually the most prevalent in the sport, and just some common misconceptions when it comes to expectations of what you need in sport, the sport itself, and how you go about training them, some conflicting issues with speed training versus conditioning, things like that. From there, we're going to talk about rotational movements, you know, hockey, baseball, lacrosse, whatever it may be, you know, how we go about training rotational movements here at my facility, and some of the most important things you can know about those movements and what you need to be doing to increase your rotational power and stuff like that. And then we're going to finish up with, you know, my kind of guidelines for in-season maintenance training, managing fatigue, how you can set up your programming to be flexible for the athletes, you know, when scheduling issues arise, you know, going about things in the right way to keep them fresh, but also try to make gains if possible in addition to maintaining. We've had some good success with that with some of our guys. Some of my hockey guys specifically this year, we've seen some great increases in verticals, front squats, guys getting stronger, and knock on wood, we've had a pretty good year injury-wise. You're obviously going to have some injuries in hockey. It's a rough sport, but we've done a good job in limiting those. It's like the best year I think we've had in my 3 years here, so I'm kind of excited about what we've been able to do with that. So we'll talk about that, and then at the end of the episode, I'm going to get into kind of what goes into the strength training assessments that I run for my guys, so the tests we use, and then kind of like my view on movement assessment, how I go about doing that. I have a bit of a different approach than the formal screenings that some trainers use. I think those are great, but I've a different way of going about it. You know, being a one-man show here, I kind of have to space things out and make them more practical. It's hard to be super, super specific with, you know, large groups of athletes. So I've kind of found a way to streamline the assessment process into, you know, how we warm up, and I'm going to kind of explain how we go about that, and then give you some insight on the testing that we use for strength and power, speed, etc., things like that. So that'll be the last thing we talk about on the episode. So getting started. So first question was regarding energy systems. This came from a high school athlete that follows me on Twitter. She basically, she asked me, you know, she's a lacrosse player, and she wanted to know how you can best go about training for the sport of lacrosse. And she kind of put in the question that it's an endurance sport. So I'm going to do my best to answer that. And before we get started, I kind of wanted to just use part of her question to just explain something right off the bat. So she asked if, you know, how you would go about training the energy systems for lacrosse as an endurance sport. So first thing off the bat that I want to kind of get into is team sports, baseball, hockey, basketball, lacrosse, soccer, football, anything. Basically, team sports, think of, you know, non-individualized sports such as like tennis, cross country, track, things of that nature. So when it comes to team sports, generally speaking, basically what it comes down to is a breaking up into anaerobic and aerobic energy systems. Aerobic involving the energy system that is lower intensity. It kind of fuels your recovery between anaerobic bouts. Anaerobic bouts being max speed bouts that are within 12 to 15 second windows. You know, where creatine, phosphate, and ATP stores. Those are, you know, fueling those movements. And basically, when they are used up, you no longer are in that anaerobic threshold because you are now unable to exert maximum intensity for the activity. So first things first, basically what it comes down to is the lactic energy system, which is basically once you use up those stores of creatine, phosphate, and ATP in anaerobic activity, and you are not given enough time to recover, the body can't break down the energy or the compounds that are used to fuel you, they begin to, and I'm making this as simple as possible so you can understand it, so I hope no one picks on me for keeping this very very light and easy to understand, but they cannot, you know, get flushed out and you know, I guess restored, so to speak. So what happens is lactic acid, you know, lactate, so to speak, begins to surface in the muscles. That's that burning feeling that you get. And you, what you'll find is that that state itself, that lactic state, is not as common in team sports as a lot of people may think. So what you want to think of right off the bat with how you're going to train your energy systems is separate anaerobic and aerobic. You train them separately. And you're really never going to cross into that lactic threshold. And there are times when you can do it, because you know you want to be prepared for the times that you do get in those situations, and we'll talk about how you can do that. But you really want to separate your energy system training to aerobic and anaerobic, right? So think of team sports, and I'll use lacrosse in this example because the young woman who asked the question is a lacrosse athlete. Excuse me. So if you think of lacrosse, right, and I'm not that familiar with it, but it's similar to sports that I am more familiar with. You know, hockey is a good example. Field hockey, lacrosse, I'm trying to think, like basketball, right? You are exerting yourself for long periods of time, but you have to understand this. Rarely in these sports are you put in a position where you're exerting max intensity into an activity for more than like that 12 to 15 seconds. Like, you might constantly be moving throughout these sports, but it's short windows that you're exerting max intensity into the sport itself. So you're not going to be playing lacrosse and running in a full sprint up and down the field for a minute at a time. It just doesn't, as far as I know, it doesn't happen. So what it comes down to is, basically, you may be in a position on the field where you have to do a dead sprint for 10 seconds to either catch someone, you're just running yourself to get down the field and try to score, whatever it may be. And after that 10 to 12 seconds is up, odds are you're going to coast around a little bit. You know, you might be in like a kind of like a midfield set, so to speak, where you're kind of like playing more of like a static defense. Or whatever you may have in that case. So what's going on in this situation is that, well, after you exert yourself on that max intensity for that 10 to 15 seconds, you're going to be able to kind of rest, so to speak. Your heart rate goes down a little bit. You're not at that max intensity anymore. So the aerobic system then kicks in, and the aerobic system is responsible for flushing out the system and, you know, kind of being the catalyst for recovery. So you're giving your body time to restore those things like the creatine, phosphate, and the ATP that I previously mentioned. Those are the main drivers of anaerobic activity. You're giving those time to replenish so they can be used, and you can actually exert maximum effort into the next bout you have to do eventually. So the key of a good aerobic system is that it kind of speeds up that process, and it makes you more effective and efficient in recovery. So it could take you less time if you have a better aerobic system, and it can allow you to kind of exert more anaerobic activity more often and for maybe a little bit longer period of time. All right. So, as I said, rarity of presence of lactic acid in team sports. There are times when that can happen, right? There can be a time where, you know, pace of a game gets picked up a little bit. You are exerting yourself a little more with less recovery. Think of a two-minute drill in football, right? Guys are running right back to the line. They're going to do a sprint, or they're going to do a max effort block if they're a lineman, whatever it may be, and they might not have enough time to recover in between because, like I said, it's a two-minute drill. you could look at hockey, I guess, maybe on a power play. Guys are, you know, going full speed a little longer if they're on the shorthanded side of things, or even if they're on the they're on the upper hand and they're just exerting themselves a little more to put pressure on and score. But like I said, it can happen, but it's not as common as like the regular, you know, 80 to 90% bulk of the sport itself. With that being said, looking at the aerobic conditioning versus anaerobic, right? So some of the easiest ways to improve your anaerobic, and I'll go over the anaerobic first. Some of the easiest ways to improve your anaerobic, and people don't even realize this, is a lot of lifting. If you're doing low rep sets of squats, bench press, whatever you're doing, is a great way. Box jumps is a great way right off the bat to work on that anaerobic conditioning. So what it really involves, as I said, is that max effort of activity for 12 to 15 seconds with rest, full recovery in between, and then you go at it again once you've fully recovered. So basically, the better you can get at, I guess, increasing your max output in those 12 to 15 seconds. So if you're doing sprint work, resting in between, squats, whatever it is, that is training your anaerobic system. So that is working on your ability to put your max intensity, your max capacity into an activity for those 12 to 15 seconds. Now, aerobic conditioning. A lot of people think aerobic conditioning off the bat has to be nonstop activity. Go run 2 miles, jog 2 miles, pitchers in baseball, go do pulls nonstop. What happens with that, and the problem with that, is that if you, even if it's a light jog, or if you're doing something for too long a period of time, even at a lower intensity, if the time spent is just, if it's too long and done too continuously, the heart rate gets raised to a level for too long of a period of time, you're still going to bring that lactic acid into your system. So what happens is you end up training what's called lactic power. And that can be beneficial. Like, you can do some lactic power training for those rare times in sport if you want to be prepared for when you have to be able to put your max power output when you're in the presence of lactate in your muscles, right? So there are strategies to do that. Things such as burning out your muscles, fatiguing your muscles, let's just say, with a high rep set of squats, light squats, and then going right into your heavy work and trying to condition your body to be able to handle the heavier loads after they've already been fatigued. So that's something that is a strategy that you can use. So you can do that if you want to be prepared for those times where you're going to have to put max output in during your sport while you're fatigued and while lactate is present in your muscles. However, if you're training to truly hit your aerobic system, and like I said, your aerobic system is what is used to fuel and recover between anaerobic bouts, you want to make sure that you're not pushing your body into that lactic state. One of the best ways to do that, interval or circuit training. Body weight exercises in, you know, a 20 seconds on, 30 seconds off kind of window, 15 to 20 minutes. Tempo runs are a great one if you have outdoor ability to get out and do some tempo runs. Basically, you know, maybe if you're doing a 50 or 60 yard sprint, working in 75% of your max speed output, and kind of just doing, let's just say you run a 50 yard sprint in 10 seconds, just using round numbers here, and you want to work on your aerobic capacity, you can do tempo runs at 13 and a half seconds, which would be like 75% of your, or 65% of your max output, to kind of train that energy system. So a way to look at aerobic capacity in terms of either percentage of your output or percentage of your heart rate. So aerobic recovery, you can use aerobic activities also to recover. So think of, you know, 65 to 70% of your max output as like that aerobic recovery. It's stimulating blood flow. I'll actually get to this a little bit later on in the portion about in-season training, how you can use aerobic circuits to produce recovery effect. So that 65 to 70% of intensity, or, you know, in that heart rate range, is going to be more of recovery. Then you look at aerobic maintenance. That's where you're trying to just maintain your aerobic capacity level. Think of, you know, keeping yourself in that 75 to 80% threshold. So I mentioned the tempo runs, right? Instead of maybe doing 70% of your max speed, you do 80%. That's going to maintain your aerobic capacity. And when we're talking rest periods for these tempo runs, think of that 45 seconds to a minute. You could do a plank. You could do something of active recovery in between. Totally fine. And adjust and periodize the volume accordingly. So like anything else you would do, squats, bench, whatever it is, strength training, plyometrics, have the volume be adjusted week by week. So you're not going to just go out there and do 12 tempo runs every single week. Adjust. You start with 6, go to 8, go to 10. Go back down. Maybe you start with 65% in the first 3 weeks, build your number of reps up, and then you drop the reps down as you increase the percentage. Think of things like that. You have recovery, as I mentioned. You have maintenance. And then you want to look at increasing your aerobic capacity. Think of that 85 to 90% of your threshold. Again, not exerting it for too long where lactic acid will begin to set in. So I said in a max output, you're looking at 12 to 15 seconds in an anaerobic window until lactic acid or lactate begins to set into the muscles and the recovery processes don't have enough long enough time to flush everything out. Same thing kind of works with the aerobic training. So the lower the percentage of your max effort output that you're doing, you can exert for a little longer period of time. So when you're in that recovery window and that 65 to 70%, you can probably work upwards to like that 45 seconds because it's a less percentage of your max output. So you're going to see less, you'll have more time, until that lactic acid state is, that lactic state is reached. As you go up in percentage, the time really starts to go down. So keep that in mind. One last thing that I really want to touch on. There's a huge difference, and you see this all the time, in speed training and conditioning slash lactic fatigue. So what I mean by that? Having your athletes go outside and run 40-yard sprints and then giving them 10 seconds rest and having them go again is not speed work. Speed work involves full recovery between the bouts, and we like to use a 6 second per yard. So a 10-yard sprint would be a minute rest, essentially. Because you need to have all of your energy stores replenished so you can put your maximum output into the sprint. That is the only time it is considered speed work. I'll say that again. You must have full recovery between your sprints and your power activities for them to truly be speed or power activities. If there is not enough rest, they either, one, become conditioning slash aerobic work, and if there's way too much intensity emphasized and not enough rest, then it becomes the lactic threshold gets crossed, and now you're more so working lactic power. You need to understand that, coaches. Having your athletes run sprints with minimal rest in between at a high intensity is not speed work. Don't call it that. It's conditioning. Understand the difference. The best way to go about training your energy systems is to separate them. Train your anaerobic with your sprints, with your jumps, with your heavy lifting. Train your aerobic with the circuit work. Understand that the output cannot be too high and the rest too low, or else it is not aerobic and it crosses into that lactic area. If you are going to train with the higher intensity and the less rest, understand what you are actually training. You are working on your lactic power output. How much energy can you exert when your body is still in that threshold where it is fatigued and not allowed to recover fully? Understand the differences between the three of those. Moving on. Next question I had, and this is from the same athlete, involved a question regarding the upper back and training for rotational movements. First thing I want to say is obviously the upper back is super, super important. Even for sports like baseball, obviously, and protecting the shoulder with throwing. I work with a lot of hockey athletes, keeping their shoulders, upper backs strong and working on their posture and their shoulder and preventing inward shoulder rotation. It's huge for trying to limit shoulder injuries that could happen due to collisions and hits. So things like that. So first things first, I want to say that we do a lot of upper back work, but I think it can be misleading that people think the upper back has to be worked in order to be an effective rotational athlete. Yes, it contributes, but in my opinion, the movements we do in terms of a push and a pull are greater contributors to the overall importance of rotation than just specific upper back work. I want you to think of upper back work, and I'm talking like a face pull, YWT, etc. That is more of an accessory that you use to build your pulls and your pushes, right? People are more and more starting to understand, even in baseball, because baseball is a world where like everyone for years was afraid of push exercises, for injuring for pitchers and stuff like that. The push pattern itself, I'm talking a push up, a landmine press, what have you. Super, super beneficial in developing scapular control. When you go through a push and you go down into flexion, so the eccentric portion, your scaps retract, so to speak, and your shoulders go into external rotation. And then when you press, the scaps work upward, right? Upward scap action is really important for throwing athletes. As the arm comes through, the trunk fires forward. The scap plays a big role in thrusting and driving forward, right? Then, not to mention the key characteristics of a good push, external shoulder rotation, good scapular retraction. All those things come together. They are super critical for rotational athletes. Whether you're taking a lacrosse shot, a hockey slap shot, swinging a baseball bat, throwing a ball, the upper back is going to come into play, but you can really, really develop a strong and properly moving upper back through things such as pushes, chin-ups, inverted rows, landmine presses, etc. Develop quality scap movement through pushes and pulls. It will go a super, super long way into increasing your rotational ability and making you more proficient with that. So, moving on from the upper body, speaking on more rotation, another question was about the upper back, but I kind of want to just cover general ways to improve your rotational ability. Obviously, looking at the lower half in a general way, squats, hinges, single leg exercises, developing strength and power in all of those in a general fashion will go a long way in improving your overall rotational output. But if you really want to get specific, once you move on from more of that general sense, like I said, unilateral activities. Two of the most important things you can do as a rotational athlete are developing strength in unilateral strength, so single leg exercises, split squats, Cossack squats, reverse lunges, sled variations, prowler pushes, things of that nature. Having unilateral leg strength can go a long way. Think about it. It's an asymmetrical activity. You're pushing off one leg. You're landing on one leg. Very important to have unilateral strength and power, right? Unilateral plyometrics, being able to absorb force, important for things like a pitcher with that lead leg when it lands, to be able to block and transfer energy up the chain. Plyometrics I found are key for pitchers in that regard. Just another example. The next thing, as I said, two things. The next thing, the frontal plane. So think of the frontal plane as like if you're standing, any movement directly to your right or directly to your left, right? So when you're swinging a baseball bat, and you take a stride, your left leg, if you're a righty, is moving across the frontal plane. Energy is transferring. Before rotation takes place, energy transfers in a lateral fashion across the frontal plane. So, before you worry about just strictly working rotational power, you really need to understand that before that happens, you need to be efficient and strong in transferring energy across the frontal plane in a lateral fashion, right? So, really work on that. Again, work it strength-wise, work it dynamically. So, Cossack squat, good example of a way to do it in the strength fashion. A lateral sled drag, etc. In the dynamic portion, lateral jumps. Lateral jumps and being able to land on that leg and stick and hold and absorb the ground can go a long, long way in rotational movements. And that's the same for lacrosse, hockey, whatever it is. You know, the tools are changing in terms of what you're holding in your hands, and some of the finer points are a little different, but overall, frontal energy transfer prior to rotation, huge thing to make sure you work on. Now, moving on to the rotational component itself. Obviously, a lot of people know that to be able to rotate strongly, you have to rotate. You have to practice rotating, build power, med ball slams, med ball throws, very popular, right? The biggest thing that a lot of people don't understand is the importance of anti-rotational core stability slash strength, right? What I mean by that, the core is what braces and stabilizes your spine when your extremities are moving. Essentially, a rotational movement is only as strong as your body's ability to resist. There's a concept known as tangent force. Tangent force essentially is thinking of your core strength out in front of you. Like again, you're standing straight ahead. Your tangent force or your anterior core strength is that plane that's like if you drew a line straight out from your belly button, right? So now I want you to think you have that line straight out from your belly button. That's your anterior core strength, right? And then you drew a line after you got to your belly button out to the right. You made a right angle, right? To move your pelvis and initiate rotation, the stronger that line out from your belly button is and your anterior core strength is, the more torque needs to be placed against it to initiate rotation for your body. So, farmer's walks, Pavlov press variations, things of that nature that increase your anti-rotational ability to resist rotation, forces your body to put more power and force to initiate rotation. As we know, what you put into an action comes out of an action. Newton's second law. Every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So if you're putting more force into rotation, more force comes out of rotation. Anterior core strength is super important. One, to brace the spine while the extremities are moving, to give you the ability to have a strong base to support your movements. But even more than that, you need to be able to resist rotation, so your body actually has to put more force in because it's moving a tighter and more rigid core, if that makes sense. So a little bit of a recap on that. Upper back, important. More important to support health of the shoulder and the upper half with rotational movements, and to be an accessory to support building proficiency in your pushes and pulls. Pushes and pulls have a huge benefit for rotational athletes with how the upper back works, developing scapular strength, etc. Moving on, single leg exercises. Going even further than that, frontal plane, left to right, lateral. Before a movement becomes rotational, it moves across the frontal plane. From there, training your core in anti-rotational, stability-driven fashion to support your extremities while they move, but to also force your body to put more into a rotational movement. Rotation becomes more powerful when more energy has to be placed in to get the body to rotate to begin with. From there, yes, your general rotational activities are great. A general way that I look into progressing through rotation is in this fashion. First and foremost, work on clearing your upper back, your T-spine. Think about your mid-back and your shoulders. A simple sledgehammer swing or rotational med ball slam is a great way to get an athlete proficient at rotating the shoulders and driving them back through. Work on your mobility of your mid-back so that you can flex and extend in a proper fashion to be able to clear your shoulders through the activity. Number two, adding a weight shift. Get yourself in that split frontal position and kind of add a forward shift to a backward shift into a slam. Get your body used to shifting forward and back across the frontal plane prior to rotation. After you get to that point, adding hops and jumps into rotation, increasing the overall power output and the dynamic nature of the movement itself. So basically that's how I like to break down rotational movements. But always understand that you need to build a strong core to make the rotational power able to be exerted in the proper fashion. Moving on to our next question. This was regarding maintenance training, basically how I go about doing it, some of my recommendations for how you can train your athletes in season. So first and foremost, how I structure strength training, I'm going to base this on a three-day week, and I'm going to use my hockey guys as an example because they're a team that are two teams specifically that I work with 3 days a week, you know, that I'm battling with them through a 6 to 7 month season, 40 to 50 games at more with the playoffs. So practices, power skating, etc. So we have our work cut out for us in terms of keeping them fresh, but also trying to make some gains because these are guys that are trying to progress and get to the college level. So although we are trying to keep them fresh, we are still trying to make improvements for them, increase their strength and power and speed and everything like that. So first things first, and this is just kind of a way that I structure things. It's to just give you an idea. You don't have to do it this way. But basically what I do, and I still periodize for strength training in the in-season time, and I guess I kind of just alter the percentages to reflect the extra fatigue that may sit in due to gameplay and practices, etc. So a brief example, basically instead of working in like that 80 to, you know, 95 upwards to max percentage window that I do in the off season, I found good success with starting the guys in that like 65 to 70% window and keeping them no higher than 90%. So the 90% would be for the last week of the cycle where they're working only like sets of one. And it's a good way to kind of expose them to a little bit of a higher threshold of their max and potentially increase their overall strength. But basically what it does is it doesn't fatigue them too much. So basically 90% is, like I said, a great way to give them that strength work or that higher exposure to the higher load to kind of keep them in condition to maintain their strength, but at the same time, it's not over fatiguing them. So like that 65 to 90% window is somewhere that I like to live, and the reps would kind of just go down coinciding with the percentage increase, basically. So similar to how I would work it for an off season, where you're kind of doing a pyramid style, just gradually expose the nervous system to higher loads with less reps, and it really makes for a good max preparation slash testing in the off season. We do the same thing in the in season, just with lower percentages. And what we found is those 65 to 90% percentages still do yield some gains. So I had a, like, you know, group of 30 to 40 athletes probably see an average of a 30-pound increase in 3 to 4 months of our first fall and winter part of the in-season with my hockey guys, just living in that 65 to 90%. Bringing me to the dynamic now. So the thing you have to understand about dynamic training is that it's very taxing on the nervous system, right? Nervous system is what controls our movements. If it's fried, we'll be feel very fatigued and slow, maybe not necessarily sore, but just very run down, right? So you want to I still want to input dynamic work in this in-season period, but I want to be careful with how I'm doing it. And what I mean by that is, in the off-season, I might be putting a lot of velocity-based dynamic work into programming. So I'm talking about jumps into jumps, aka counter movements, very, very light and fast barbell work, you know, a lot of sprint training, stuff like that. So the first thing is, we're not really doing any sprint training while the guys are in season. So these two hockey teams, they're getting plenty of speed work while they're in their skates and on the ice, right? They're going hard in practice, they're playing games. They're not going to need any additional speed work in here. They're doing basically essentially sprints in their skates 3 to 4 days a week at least. So that's first thing. We eliminate the sprint work. Unless maybe you are in a position like football where you're playing one day a week, if you want to do an extra day of sprint work, that is totally fine. And I do have some of my younger hockey guys still do sprint work if they're playing less games. It depends on the schedule. Again, it's always an it depends, and you have to adjust and make sense of this based on what you have in front of the information. How many times a week are they practicing? How many times a week are they playing? My junior guys have such a rigorous schedule that I really eliminate the speed component, where some of the younger guys may have a decent amount of games, but they're not practicing as much. If they're playing high school and club hockey, they might just only be training one day a week altogether. It can really limit their potential to work, right? So moving forward with more of the dynamic talk, you want to make sure that you're doing it, but that you're not overtaxing the nervous system. You shouldn't be doing dynamic work twice a week when you have guys that are in season and that are practicing and playing 4 to 3 to 4 to 5 times a week. You're going to kill them. You're going to burn out their nervous system, right? And you want to keep it to more of the basic dynamic work. My guys at most are doing basic sets of box jumps, single leg or bilateral, and just emphasizing that fast load just to keep their stretch shortening cycle, their elasticity component high, and their power output high to maintain it. We're not trying to burn it out, right? If there's an off week, we can go a little more. Same thing with the strength work. Pick your spots. That brings you to, it's a beautiful segue to my next point. Pick your spots in terms of your in-season training. And this is a strategy I like to use. Basically what it means is, it's really kind of tempering your programming based on what's in front of you and what your athlete's schedule is. I can't tell you how many times I have conversations with coaches, the athletes themselves, asking them, what's coming up? What is your game schedule this week? Hey, it's Tuesday or Monday. We're training Monday, Wednesday this week. I don't have a game till Sunday. One game on Sunday. We might push it a little harder. What that means is that three sets of three that I had planned at 75%, which is pretty maintenance or submaximal focused, that could bump up to 90%. Hey, we're going to really just kind of get after it this week. We have an opening and an opportunity. Going into the session, are they already fatigued? Now you're going to say, okay, I'll use this lighter week, and I'm really going to give them some time off. So you kind of have to play it by what the athlete looks like. There are some objective tests you can use to measure this. Testing their vertical. What percentage of their max is their vertical? Is it super, super low and they're not getting anywhere near what their max is? They could be pretty fatigued. You might want to give them a week off. Things like that. Now, speaking of recovery, using high rep, low intensity exercises and circuit training for blood flow. I already talked about this in the energy systems portion. If you limit the max percentage of output in the activity to that 65% window, it acts as like a recovery. High rep, 15 to 20 reps, stuff like that, with lower weight that requires less exertion, can be really good at promoting blood flow throughout the body to help athletes recover. My hockey guys that I keep using as an example, on Mondays, we have a training day. After a long weekend of games, they're doing a full body template with higher reps, and I'm emphasizing lower loads and lower intensity to promote recovery for them before they do their stretch, roll out, whatever they do afterwards. It's a really good way to kind of speed up the process of the body to recover. It could honestly be better off, you're better off doing that than just totally taking the day off. This can really kind of help you through the process. I'd rather an athlete do that than sit down in an ice bucket and just totally like lock everything up and, you know, delay that healing process. I think you're much better off getting in the weight room for like a circuit-based rep, movement pattern circuit. And even if it's not a circuit, just going through the exercises at a lower intensity with the higher reps promote blood flow and recovery. Speaking of a circuit or a workout that is movement pattern based, the number one way, and this is how I train all year round because it's just how I do it, but especially in season, you could find a lot of benefit from a full body template with your training as well as implementing conjugate style. So if you're looking for that ultimate flexibility with your programming, the full body template is great because it kind of kills all of the birds with just one stone, right? So every day you're working each pattern. Nothing's getting neglected. What's good about that is if you miss a day of training, you're not like, oh, I missed my uppers work for this week. Oh, I missed my lower for this week. You're getting a little bit of that done each day. So it really kind of builds in an okay way of missing training sessions if athletes have games or what have you. Now, conjugate touches on the same thing. Obviously, I like conjugate for more reasons than just this, but a good benefit of conjugate training is that you can kind of consolidate training. If an athlete tells you, hey, coach, I usually see you twice this week, but I could only make it once, you can use that movement pattern-based program, and you can kind of make a mix between your hypertrophy, your strength, and your dynamic work on that one training day if you have to. Or you can pick and choose. What does the athlete need? Again, assessing what they look like, their rundown, their nervous system's fried. They might need recovery work on that one day they're with you. They have an off week and they're feeling good. You can really go after it with the dynamic and the strength work. Get a feel for what's going on. But having flexibility and not limiting yourself to upper lower lifts, a power block or a strength block where that's all you're working on, makes it so if sessions are missed and you have to adjust based on schedule limitations, you can be the most flexible. And that's the biggest key with in-season training. Obviously, you want to maintain the athlete and keep them healthy and fresh while making some gains if possible. But the biggest thing, too, is making sure that you can be flexible enough to adjust to whatever can come your way. It's unpredictable. The schedules are all over the place. Kids may be going out and playing for other teams that you're not even aware of or what they're doing, other training. You got to make sure that you can really be flexible with the training. And to reiterate, pick your spots. Assess the athlete accordingly. Find out where they are. Ask questions that are subjective. How do you feel? Some people may argue that you might not get a great answer from that. They're always going to tell you they're feeling good. So if you have the means to implement tests to be able to check and see what they actually are feeling, like I said, a vertical is a really easy one if you have a vertical jump mat. Know what their max is from their best and see what percentage they are in within that max. It could be a good way to see where their nervous system is and how you want to attack their training. So, moving on to the last question I had, and the last one I'm going to go over. I got a question about assessments, how I go about them, right? First things I want to say about an assessment, don't overthink it. This is not to say that having a formal process for movement screens are bad. I know plenty of the best people in the industry that use them, and it works for them. I'm just trying to let some coaches know that you don't have to do that to be a good coach and have a good assessment. What I mean by that, I've developed a protocol where I'm putting a new athlete through a general warm-up that we would do. So our general warm-up template, blood flow, to mobility, to activation, to movement patterns, to core, to nervous system activation, putting them through that and just kind of taking notes on how they move. They're going our hamstring mobility component for the day is like a Frankenstein where they're trying to drive their leg up to their opposite hand. they can't get very high with that. Red flag right away. There might be some hamstring issues. I'm just keeping this basic for you. They go to do a plank in the plank portion, and the lumbar spine is in overextension, and there's a severe pelvic tilt that could tell me that they have some abdominal core issues that need to be addressed, and we need to strengthen that area. You can have an athlete do a push-up and a squat body weight and find out a bunch about them and certain deficiencies that they may have. And as they get through that, you just continue to evaluate and make notes on what their overall movement is, how the quality is, what do they struggle with, and you can address certain things for them based on that. You don't need to, and if you want to use it, it's fine. If some people like it, that's totally okay, but you can have an athlete do a squat and see knee valgus, ankle mobility issues, hip mobility issues, back issues. Have them do a couple different types of squats. You can have them try to go hands overhead, and their upper back or their T-spine just can't handle it. Just simple things you can do to flesh out issues. And above all else, the two things I love is watch them sprint and watch them jump at the most basic level. It will tell you so much about their movement, and you can put it with what you saw from their movement patterns or basic squats and push-ups with their sprints. That's more dynamic, and you can flesh out so much. I'm not saying not to document things. You make your notes on these things that you're seeing. So maybe you're not getting as specific as measuring internal hip rotation, the degrees in which they can get, or their external, and that there's a time and a place for that. But in my experience as a coach, I run things mostly on my own. It's hard to be that hands-on with certain things like that with so many athletes. And on top of that, I like to refer a lot of my guys to an athletic trainer or a PT to not make myself a jack-of-all-trades and a master of none, so to speak. So if I'm going to get them that more in-depth look, it's going to be with someone who really, truly specializes in it. I think there's too much emphasis put on having to specialize in 500 different things as a strength coach. You can really make it basic, and you can really get a good assessment by just having your athletes move. A good coach can see movement deficiencies and address them by simply watching general movement with their athletes. Now, with that being said, moving on to how I address and how I test and assess strength / power for the athlete. A couple different things, and I'll just go through these. We pick a max effort lower body test, a front squat, a trap bar deadlift, a barbell deadlift, a back squat, whatever it is. We are just trying to get a gauge of how much force the athlete's lower half can produce, max strength, etc. We do the same thing, upper body, landmine press, resisted push-up, bench press, whatever it is. Now, relative strength. A good test for relative strength, and what relative strength is relative strength gives you an idea of how strong the athlete is relative to their body weight. This is a great test for people who work with high school athletes or even older athletes who are, you know, let's say boxers, wrestlers even, that you have to keep them in a certain weight class, or athletes that are, you know, very reliant upon speed but have to gain some size. You want a way to determine if the weight they're putting on is contributing to their functional, quote-unquote, strength and power. The chin-up is a great way, or a pull-up, whatever you want to use, is a great way to determine strength according to body weight, right? So if an athlete is 170 pounds and they do 10 chin-ups, and then you get them up to 185 pounds and they're down to 8 chin-ups, it's a good indication to you that something's going wrong with their diet. They put too much fat on. Something's not right here, that the size that they put on is not contributing to strength gains, right? You want to at least maintain your level, like your chin-up number for weight increase, or go up. So if they go to 170 to 185 and they do two more chin-ups, they got bigger, stronger, and probably faster. So it's a good way to keep yourself in check with the athletes in terms of weight gain and making sure that it's going to the right things that are going to help them. Next, if you have the means, vertical jump test. The vertical jump test, keeping it simple here in terms of my explanation, is the best way to generally assess lower half power for your athletes. High vertical jumps almost always coincide with good speed, and it's a really good way to go back and look at if your strength training and your dynamic training are going towards improving that overall power output. If you have the ability, you have a laser timer, a 10-yard sprint could be good. I say a laser timer because there's way too much human error in a stopwatch to test a 10-yard sprint, because there's such a big difference in like that 0.2 of a second that you might get different in a stopwatch. So if you have the means to do it, 10-yard sprints are great. And if you are an athlete that needs to work on some top speed, you can do like a flying 10 is a great one if you don't have that much space. So give your athlete like 15 yards to build up, and then there's like a 10-yard window where they're at top speed, and you only measure that 10 yards. So it kind of gives you an indication of like how fast they are at top speed, so you can compare it from time to time. Your biggest – and then one more thing actually too, a grip test could be good for baseball players too in terms of like, you know, the contributions that strong forearms and wrist ligaments and tendons to keeping the elbow healthy and things of that nature. I do like a certain test of like putting a fat grip or a grip expanding implement on a dumbbell and seeing how long an athlete can hold. Like, so maybe pick a uniform weight, like a 50 or 55 pound dumbbell, and see how long they can hold it for. And if they retest and it's higher, then it generally means that not only is their grip stronger, but like the musculature around that area has also better developed. So I do like that one. It's something I have played around with a little bit recently. Now, building your program around these tests, right? So you got to work from the top down here. You got to think of those tests as like the top of your programming tree, right? You need to then develop a program because you're picking tests that you find important. Like if you improve in those tests, you are basically improving at what you need for your sport, right? You're becoming a better athlete. So you need to build your program around things that improve those tests. So picking primary and indicator exercises, so to speak, and I've talked about this on the programming, building a program episode, but if you want to go back and check that out, that'll further explain. But to keep it simple here, building a program from the top to the bottom that has main indicator exercises such as those squats and those benches or whatever you're using that contribute to improving those metrics. And the great thing about it is the tests are a good way to see how effective your programming actually is. So if you go back and test and those numbers didn't go up over 2 months, you might have to go back and look at your program and see what you're missing. It's a good way to kind of keep you you honest with your program to make sure you're doing the right things. Basically, just use them as a way to see if your programming is effective, and obviously use it to see if the athlete's improving. And that kind of brings you to my last point that I wanted to talk about, was how often should you test and how often should you max, right? You see way too many people that kind of just go head-on collision with their weight training every day, and it's like every week it seems like they're maxing. Have a plan, right? I don't really think my athletes ever max more than 3 to 4 times a year. I'd say 4 times. Probably 2, maybe 3 during the off season, and they might get up to a heavy remax in an in-season just to see if they're making any progress with our sub-maximal lifting. You don't want to overdo it, right? Build out programs that are like that 6 to 8 week cycle or whatever you have, and have a plan to build up to those tests. And another reason for that is that some of these tests, like minimal results are a big deal. So if you're testing your vertical every 2 weeks, you might not see an improvement. It could make you change things that you don't necessarily have to change in your programming. So I like to space testing out to only a few times a year to really give you an idea. If you're starting out as a trainer and you want to make sure your programming is effective and you want to test, you know, once a month just to see if there's any progress being made, by all means, go ahead. But just don't overdo it. That's the biggest piece of advice I can give in terms of testing and maxing out, not to overdo it. Space it out. Give yourself time. Make sure you use the testing that I've described. Make sure you use it to keep you honest. And really, just use it to test the effectiveness of programming. The biggest thing that you can do to make sure you're writing programs that are helping the athlete the best that you can. Thank you guys for listening. I hope you find the Q&A episode useful. I would love to do more in the future. Please hit me with any questions you have. I could even make an entire episode out of a question. I actually just received a text a little while ago regarding vertical jumps and how to improve them. So I think next week's episode will actually be on verticals, you know, basically how to go about programming to improve your vertical, what goes into it, etc. With that being said, things that may be coming up or things that are going to be coming up. I think I'm going to have the opportunity to have the owner of Blast Motion on. I think I'm really excited about that. I want to kind of see, get a look into the technology. The guys I work with over at with Untamed Baseball and at Gamers Baseball Academy have been using the Blast Motion since the start of this offseason, and it's been really cool to kind of get, you know, immediate feedback on the players and see what it teaches you about what you, you know, the proper ways to maximize your swing and things of that nature. So as we know, tech is becoming big, rightfully so, in baseball. I think we're actually kind of catching up to some of the other sports. So I think that's a really, you know, important thing to discuss on the podcast and get insight from one of the bigger companies that's doing it right now and just, you know, pick their brain or his brain on what, you know, what goes into the technology and how you can use it to best, how you can use it best, essentially, to make sure you're being effective with it. In addition, I wanted to have my friends Kyle Rogers, Terry Phillips, and Steven Oster on to discuss their new venture, Baseball Health Professionals. Basically, a really, really cool idea they had. That they're you know, they're putting their foot forward with that, trying to make sure that kids can and athletes can always be and parents can always be connected and have access to the best health professionals in their area to get the best care. And just make, you know, bad care and difficulty finding quality professionals. I think of the past. I'm really excited to not only have them on and talk to them about that, but to eventually contribute to their website and hopefully link them up with some, you know, really, really good professionals on the East Coast, which is where I'm located. So super excited to I talked to Kyle today, actually, about having him on the episode with Terry and Steven to discuss, you know, their plans and what inspired them to do it, and also just kind of have like a nice roundtable discussion about all things related to strength and, you know, sports performance, recovery, and rehabilitation and things of that nature. So I'm really excited to have them on very soon. So you can look for those three things in the next few episodes coming up. As always, please like, subscribe, share if you enjoy the podcast. I'm getting some great feedback, and I think things are really moving in a positive direction with this, so I'm excited to see where we can go in the future. Thank you for listening to the Muscles and Management Podcast, brought to you by Challenger Strength. I'm your host, Jerry DiFilippo, helping you build your body and your business.